I'd like to call the meeting to order, and we don't quite have a quorum, but we're going to go ahead and get started. And today we're talking about several bonding bills, and this committee will be making recommendations that we forward to the bonding committee, I believe, on the 29th. And so what we're going to do today is actually hear the bills, and it'll be advisory to us in terms of what we would like to do as a committee. So we're going to start with Representative Nelson, House File 2481. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 2481 is a bill to request state bonding to provide for funds to rehabilitate public housing in all the counties across and units across the state of Minnesota. Currently, there's a huge backlog of maintenance and rehabilitation, and we need to address this in our public housing facilities. These units represent the housing safety net for our citizens in the state of Minnesota. The federal government has not fulfilled its obligation to provide for funds and to maintain these units. The legislature provided $2 million last year in the 2009 bonding bill for public housing rehabilitation. Those funds are being used by the public housing authorities to meet some of the state's most urgent maintenance and rehabilitation needs. This bill will continue that state partnership with our local housing authorities. And today with me, I have witnesses from the St. Paul Housing Authority and the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority who provide specific information regarding public housing rehabilitation needs and the example of how these funds work for would be put to work. So I have Bob Boyd here from the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and Alicia Huckabee, and they'll be testifying. So
thank you very much. Do you want to go forward?
Sure.
State your name for the case.
My name is Alicia Huckleby. I'm the Special Projects Coordinator at the St. Paul Public Housing Agency, and would first of all like to thank Representative Nelson, you, Representative Clark, and the rest of the committee for the opportunity to testify today in support of the $10 million in bonding for public housing rehab. Just to give you a brief overview of who the St. Paul PHA is, and I believe you also have a fact sheet that I handed out a little bit earlier. We own just over 4,200 units of public housing across the city of St. Paul. It's a combination of high-rises, family developments, and scattered site homes throughout every single neighborhood in the city. We provide affordable housing to just over 10,000 individuals in our public housing program alone, most of which are at about 21% of the median income. So that means that there is an average annual income of just under $15,000 per household for these folks. We maintain a 99% occupancy rate across the board in all of our units. And in fact, we've been at that 99 percentile for the past 14 years. So there's a great need for the housing we provide. Our waiting list speaks to that. We have over 8,000 people on a public housing waiting list. The insured value of our portfolio is over $560 million. So we're the city's largest affordable housing provider. You know, despite this significant investment, since 2002, housing authorities have historically received less capital funding from the federal government. It's been the experience of many PHAs and HRAs across the state. In fact, according to a May 2008 report published by the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I see Chip Hallbuck, the executive director, is in the audience today, the report was entitled Investment at Risk, Public Housing in Minnesota. The state's public housing properties had an estimated worth of $2 billion, but experienced a 29% decrease in capital funding cuts from 2002 to 2007. As for the PHA, our own capital fund budget is about $8 million a year, but we've experienced ourselves almost $12 million in federal capital funding cuts over the past 8 years. And according to a 2007 physical needs assessment that we did on our properties, we estimate we had, at that time, an unfunded capital needs backlog of about $77 million. Now, the recent additional federal capital fund assistance in the form of recovery funding has helped to address a portion of public housing capital needs, as well as foster job growth. We, the PHA, received about $10 million in formula-based Recovery Act funding last March, and we're very proud to say we were able to fully obligate that amount in about 9 weeks. We also, more recently, received approximately $7.1 million and competitive-based Recovery Act funding. And this money would go towards energy efficiency improvements at four of our high-rises. You know, capital improvements to our public housing properties, I don't have to tell you, not only benefit current and future residents, they also improve the surrounding community. And they generate some additional economic benefits, which was an additional purpose of the recovery funding. In fact, a national study by eConsult determined that each dollar of HUD capital funding generates $2.12 in economic supported activity in the community, and almost 15 jobs created or supported for each $1 million construction project. Here in St. Paul, for the St. Paul PHA, that means that from our formula-based money, we estimate that that would generate about 170 construction-related jobs, and for the competitive money, just over 100 construction-related jobs. And in addition to the construction-related jobs, we were also very pleased that receiving these recovery funds for capital improvements allowed us to hire 27 long-term temporary workers to help with property upkeep and resident outreach. 16 of those positions were filled by our public housing residents, which is fantastic news. However, at the same time, we have to be realistic and understand that it's not certain if there will be similar opportunities through additional capital funding in the future. So while these recovery funds did help us address some significant capital fund projects, these were just a portion, again, of the $77 million backlog that we know we have. We have a list of shovel-ready projects that are ready to go, primarily because not all of our applications for competitive-based recovery dollars were funded. We have about $8.7 million that would also have gone towards energy efficiency improvements, an additional 8 of our high-rises. And altogether, we can identify a total of $10.4 million in shovel-ready projects for high-rise safety initiatives and green initiatives similar to those that I previously mentioned. So that's why this opportunity to access funds through GO bonding to address public housing capital needs is especially important. So I understand my time is short, and I'd just like to wrap up again by thanking you for your current and past support. And by that, I'd specifically like to highlight the $5 million that became available in 2007 for the Preservation of Affordable Rental Investment Fund, Public Housing, so PARIF. We received $500,000 out of those funds that allowed us to preserve and rehab about 30 of our scattered site funds. I'd like to thank you for the $2 million bonding opportunity this year. And, you know, would like to thank you for your support of this current bill. We understand it's a tough budget cycle. Our economy has taken a turn that most would not have predicted. We're not asking you also to step in and bear a federal responsibility. However, your past support of public housing shows that Minnesota recognizes and it values its public housing investment and realizes the importance of helping to preserve what is, especially in these times, a safety net for many of our poorest and most vulnerable citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Huckleberry. Any questions? Any members? Okay.
Representative Clark, other representatives, my name is Bob Boyd. I'm Director of Policy and Special Initiatives for the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority. And like my colleague here, I'm here to support House File 2481, Public Housing Rehabilitation Funding Bonds. MPHA is overall responsible for the ownership and operations of some 6,207 public housing units, including 4,958 high-rise, 753 scattered sites, and 184 family units, along with 312 mixed finance developments. We also administer over 4,400 housing choice voucher programs, and through our public housing and Section 8 programs, house over 22,000 low-income elderly and disabled individuals. Like our friends at St. Paul, we have enormous waiting lists in both our public housing and Section 8. And to show you how strong the need for affordable housing was, in 2008 we opened our Section 8 housing waiting list for 2 days, and we had over 15,000 applications. and the system was overwhelmed and shut down, or we could have had thousands more. Through its various programs, the Public Housing Authority has experienced some significant challenges, and also this year in 2009 some opportunities as we try to serve our very low income and vulnerable population. Similar to St. Paul, did a significant housing needs assessment in 2006 and identified over $225 million in unmet needs, and we reevaluated that system just last year, and it is now over $245 million to meet its cost. And like St. Paul, 2010, we've been both fortunate and we think strategic to position us well for 2010, and I want to go over some of those opportunities. With our HUD Capital Fund allotment, and MPHA is the only housing authority that has moving to work authority, so we're able to move some funds from our Section 8 to our capital, and we have allocated over $16 million for capital needs improvements in 2010. We have also received $18.2 million in Recovery Act funds, and we successfully negotiated a $33.5 million deal with Honeywell International HUD for infrastructure improvements for our high-rises that are energy-related that will pay for themselves out of the savings. And then we were also able to successfully compete for a little over $31.5 million in additional ERA funds for special projects under National Competitive. So you may be asking, with all those resources to bear, why am I sitting here? And let me try to explain that, because while we're proud of what we've accomplished, we have significant issues. As noted, we have over $245 million in unmet capital needs, and ERA was only a one-time event. Unmet needs is demonstrated by our $20 million increase in just 2 years, grow and even become more expensive when the fixes are not addressed immediately, and we do not have the resources to address those fixes. The public housing resource for today not only enhances our properties today, but it's really a public investment in the future. And if we allow those buildings to deteriorate today, the fix is more, and the resource availability for future generations gets lost. Also, we recognize we're well positioned for this year, but the public housing authorities around the state did not get as much capital. They did not get as much other resources as we've been able to do, and they haven't been able to use their moving to work flexibility. So I'm here to speak not just on MPHA's behalf, but on the needs of the housing authorities across the state who are suffering critical needs that federal resources aren't there to address. Finally, the public housing preservation bonds serve two really critical investments. As my colleagues from St. Paul pointed out, that recent study shows, again, that for every dollar of public housing capital funds invested, it generates $2.12 of economic activity in the local economy. And for every $150,000 of capital fund investments, a housing-related job happens. And what that will do when the state of Minnesota bonding dollars are combined with the other dollars that we have received, it gives us really an opportunity to impact the local economy, both in jobs in terms of economic activity in our local economies, that absent those funds would be diminished. And I think it's critical with the state of Minnesota suffering the economic crisis it is, that as legislators, you have an opportunity to make sound investments that capitalize on dollars that are already available to public housing authorities and make those investments more meaningful. And the second, equally critical, is what I call the mission investment. The state of Minnesota has always strongly and powerfully responded to the needs of its most vulnerable citizens. And what I have to tell you today, if we don't make appropriate investments in the public housing infrastructure that we have, that investment will be lost, not just for folks tomorrow, but folks well into future generations. It's like anything. We have to be good stewards of our resources. And the bonding bill has provided MPHA in the past, and we look forward to the opportunity to use those funds to preserve our resources for the future, while at the same time investing in our local economy and creating jobs for this very real crisis that we have now. I thank you and am willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? I do have one question. I've represented a number of buildings that certainly need this kind of repair. Some of them are very, very serious repairs. I was shocked when I visited some of them and some of the units, some of the conditions. And so I see that, you know, we're asking here, in Representative Nelson, under your bill, I believe, for $10 million. Governor's recommending $5 million, right? So what's not going to get done? Do we have any... I'm not asking you specifically, but I'll ask hopefully the representatives of the governor for that too, from the Housing Finance Agency. But I'm just wondering if you've thought about, since that announcement came out, if you've thought about what that might mean. Anybody of you care to answer?
Madam Chair, members, let me share this with you. We continually make strategic decisions about what to do and not what to do based on the resources we have. And again, as I point out, we have $245 million in unmet needs. So what we try to do is we class all our needs into three classes, one being health and safety, two being critical infrastructure, and three being more curb appeal appearance, routine things that make livability at issue. And we have to structure more and more on those code compliance life needs that make great infrastructure changes, but they do not do anything for helping people have that sense of livability and appearance and whatever else that makes someone's place to live a home. And so as we have to structure and prioritize more in there, we're confident about our systems running, but we are less confident about being able to keep and help the families who need decent places to live that feel like a home.
Thank you. Ms. Huckabee?
I would agree with what Bob said. We all have our priority list of modernization work that needs to get done. And our units all undergo significant numbers of inspections and preventative maintenance inspections and annual inspections, as well as inspections that are conducted by the federal government. I know for St. Paul PHA, what these funds will allow us to do is address some additional life safety initiatives that we've been working on, actually, for years. One that I could give you right now has to do with sprinkling and upgrading the fire alarm systems in our high-rises. For the past 16 years, the St. Paul PHA has been working with the St. Paul Fire Marshal to ensure that all of our buildings are sprinkled, and then when you do that, you have to upgrade the fire alarm systems. And on average, it was costing between $500,000 to $1 million a building. Funds that we didn't have at the time to devote to that because we had to address other more serious capital fund needs. And so we have about three buildings to go, excuse me. And so that money, $5 million available for total, is $5 million that we didn't have or wouldn't have had before. And so it would allow us to address, I know for St. Paul PHA, some priority high-rise life safety initiatives that we wouldn't have been able to address otherwise.
Okay. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would, to either of the testifiers, I would just like to know, and I apologize if I missed part of this, if you mentioned it earlier, but what provisions are you looking at for energy efficiency as you're talking about some of this livability? I mean, with respect to long-term savings of public dollars, I just didn't happen to hear you talk very much about that. I would like to know where that sits in your, priority list of what you're looking at?
Speak briefly for St. Paul PHA. I mentioned we had over $8 million in applications for competitive recovery money that were unfunded. And so that money would have gone for lighting improvements. It would have gone for window replacement. We're trying to replace all of the windows in our high-rises because that goes helps us a long way towards energy efficiency. We're also doing some boiler replacements and, of all things, toilet replacements in our buildings as well. And so all of those items are shovel-ready projects that as soon as we receive funding for, we're ready to go on. So they all center pretty much around energy efficiency improvements and or high-rise safety improvements such as the sprinklers that I mentioned previously.
For MPHA, most all our initiatives have a green focus to them. For example, the $33.5 million deal we have with Honeywell are all surrounded around energy conservation, utility saving, consumption savings, and we expect, again, out of that deal to be able to pay for that out of the savings. With our other capital investments, we are looking at all new windows on our scattered site properties. We are looking at new furnaces. We are looking at LED lighting, and we have an opportunity to build two new buildings. One of them is fully green, both in its construction and the use of solar and geothermal heat. So every initiative we have has a green focus. The question is, that costs a little bit more, but it saves in the long run. So we're looking, again, for a way of strategically investing those dollars. So up front, the more pays off at the end.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that, who are you working with regard to, you know, who's telling you to replace windows? I mean, who are you working with? Are you working with the utilities? Are you working with Office of Energy Security? Who is helping you get through that? Who's on board with that, please?
Actually, the St. Paul PHA worked with pretty much all of those entities, our utility company. We had consultants come in. We also sent out invitations to organizations such as Anderson Windows to come in and look at the current energy efficiency of our windows, which we knew at the outset wasn't what it used to be. So we are consulting with outside organizations on that.
Similarly, for MPHA, we, for our energy improvements, we did an RFP soliciting an energy consultant. We've worked, and Honeywell persevered in that response. We have also working with architects who have LEED experience and meet Green Communities Act standards and are utilizing those consultants for choice in product purchases and how we move forward in this. We're trying to be very strategic.
Since we're talking about windows, I did a question. One of the problems, of course, in many of our older homes, and I'm thinking here of the scattered site public housing, it's the whole issue of childhood lead poisoning and the windows that need to be replaced because of that. Are you able to do two for one in some of these situations or get any additional assistance that way? Or I know that money is also very short. I'm just wondering if I think that certainly is a life safety issue, and I'm wondering if you've calculated what that might be in terms of actual costs or need.
Chairman Clark and representatives, MPHA's capital fund department is more versed in that. I know that we have looked at that. Again, we wrote and received a competitive grant from HUD for $11.5 million that is specifically focused on green for our public housing scattered site areas, and total window replacement is part of that deal. And but in terms of the specifics of how that's accomplished, it would be the person from our capital fund department who could best speak to that.
Okay. Yeah. I would have to agree with Bob. You know, as federally funded organizations, there are requirements that we have to meet in terms of lead paint and abatement and notifying residents, but I too would want to point to our capital improvements folks for the details of that question.
Well, then, Representative Nelson, I have a question, I guess, maybe just if they can get back to me and you can help make sure that it gets to our committee. I think it's really a really important life safety issue for many of our housing units that are public housing, lots of little children living in them. And so if you can just get back to us with some information on that and what the life safety need is there, that would be helpful. Thank
you. They're both writing it down.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Just one other one that I had. Mr. Boyd, you mentioned the moving to work funding, and I'm not quite sure that I understood exactly how the use of the money was shifting there. Could you explain that just a little bit more, please?
Chairwoman Clark and representatives, moving to work is a special status granted to, I think it's now up to 30 public housing authorities throughout the country. And that status allows housing authorities to combine all their funding that they receive into a single fund and then allocate that funding resource based on priorities of the agency rather than having to operate through silos. For MPHA in the past, we would have some extensive operational needs in our low rent program, and we had extensive Section 8 reserves out there from years when the housing market was very tight and landlords weren't utilizing Section 8, and all we could do is look at those reserves and not allocate them. Under moving to work, those reserves are available to help us move and utilize for our capital program and our operational programs. In addition, we can cut bureaucratic things that seem to be very costly. For example, for our elderly residents, St. Paul has to take those folks through an annual recertification every year, even though with Social Security not changing much or whatever else, they have to spend all the time and expense to do that. MPHA was able to waive that under moving to work and do that recertification once every 3 years, and we can then take the dollars we would save in that activity and focus them on other administrative costs. It just makes a lot of sense and provides a lot of flexibility, but it's still a demonstration program by National HUD, and we're the only ones who can do that in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you very much. Unless there's any further questions,
In conclusion, I just want to say that even though it's Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Housing here doing the testifying today, this is a program for the whole state of Minnesota. It's not just the metro area. It'll affect housing authorities in Duluth, housing authorities in northern Minnesota and southern Minnesota. So this is, as we go forward with this, this money will allow these agencies to leverage other funds and make a broader impact just on the $10 million or $5 million if that's what the governor ends up with his proposal. It'll be able to make this money go farther, have a 2 or 3 to 1 return on the investment we make. Okay, thank you for hearing the bill.
Yes, thank you so much. I believe the testimony, Ms. Orr is here from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, would like to testify too, so you can just stay there a moment if you wish to. Representative Nelson, I want to thank the witnesses for coming today. We really appreciate your advice and information. It's a very compelling situation, so I'm really happy that you came and gave us some of the numbers and some of what it means. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency. Madam Chair, as you know, the Housing Finance Agency made a request for $10 million in GO bonds to rehabilitate public housing. We also requested a total of $30 million in nonprofit housing bonds, a debt service for those, to address foreclosure remediation activities, supportive housing needs for people experiencing homelessness. The governor on Friday announced his capital bonding bill, and unfortunately, the from our standpoint, so I've just on the record, the governor's bill only includes $5 million for nonprofit housing bonds for foreclosure remediation activities and supportive housing. It does not include any money for public housing at this point. As you know, last year $2 million was included in the small bonding bill for public housing rehabilitation. That money is going to all be committed at the January board meeting this month. And you were talking about energy conservation. We did make a priority in the funding request for projects that would address energy conservation. And we have a variety of of applications that will be funded, including a geothermal project in southeastern Minnesota. So we did make an effort to combine the state's resources to be used both for public housing rehabilitation and to achieve some energy conservation.
Okay, thank you. Just to clarify, so there are no public housing bonds recommendations from the government. He's recommending zero to the issues that we just heard from Representative Nelson. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you so much for coming down, and thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson? Welcome to your committee. Okay, Representative Benson, we don't have a number for your bill yet, but we're happy to see for us because it will have a number shortly.
Thank you. It might be 4641.
4641?
104641.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair,
for
the opportunity to present this moderate bonding bill before the committee. And I'll just make a couple of comments and then open it up for questions. And I have two knowledgeable presenters here who can assist us in evaluating this particular bill. The bill is calling for $5 million in bonding to nonprofit grants to community land trusts to acquire land for permanently affordable housing. And that word, permanently, I think is a very important aspect of this particular bonding proposal because not only does it increase leverage of federal, state, and local resources to rehabilitate approximately 200 affordable housing units, which would increase the Minnesota total to 875 homes, because this program has already been in effect in a number of other places, particularly the Rochester, Minnesota area, and also Duluth area, and Minneapolis, and around the state, actually. The home, in this case, under this program, is when it is resold, the state investment remains so that the house is permanently affordable for the next moderate or low-income homeowner. One of the problems, I think, in housing development has been that with the assistance to help people get a moderately priced home, when that home is sold, then the market begins to force it into higher brackets and makes it difficult then to maintain a stock of affordable housing. Also, this program, since the home is owned by the buyer, it does help to motivate them to maintain the home, provides more stability for the community as well. So the program protects the affordability of housing, and some of the advantages over other programs is that the guarantee for affordable housing usually runs about 30 years in conventional purchases, but this makes it possible to maintain it for 99-year renewable ground lease. The owners have full access of the land, but because it is not part of the property itself when it's sold, it guarantees subsequent homeowners that they will be low and moderate income people. So, with that brief introduction, I'd like to open up for questions, and I'd like to introduce Pat Steger and Sean Allen.
Welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Pat Steger. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Community Land Trust. I'd like to thank Representative Benson for introducing our bill today, and Chair Clark and members of the community for hearing our testimony. I'd also like to let everyone know that the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition and our 9-member organizations also support the broader bill, bonding bill to afford the continuum of affordable housing needs across Minnesota. I think you have to move over here. I just want to cover a few key points, and actually Representative Benson stole my thunder and covered most of them, but I'm going to make sure that I try to fill it. That's actually great. Really appreciate his support, and I want to just fill in a couple other things that you may or may not know about CLTs, fondly called, or Community Land Trust, fondly called CLTs. They've been operating in the United States since the 1980s, and a lot of people aren't aware of that, and actually in Minnesota for over 20 years now. There are 9-member member organizations throughout the state of Minnesota in Duluth, Rochester, Chaska, Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Cloud, Lake Elmo, and Minnetonka, and each one of those serves their surrounding community, and some of them very multiple cities and a very large area. To date, we have approximately 675 permanently affordable homes for people with low to moderate incomes. One of the unique things about community land trusts is that it has both a social and a financial component. As Representative Benson said, it is the CLT holds title to the land, which protects the public investment for preserving long-term affordability. And the great thing about nonprofit housing bonds is that that allows the land trust to purchase the land and hold it with a 99-year lease. It also helps us leverage other public and private dollars to purchase land and rehabilitate foreclosed and vacant properties and other targeted properties. The average CLT homeowner stays around 7 years, so you can do the math in a 99-year lease that helps that home recycle to the next family of lower moderate income. Land trust homes are very stable. The land trust model requires 30-year fixed-rate mortgages and owner occupancy, which also adds to stability of the neighborhood. It's also a very people-focused approach. The CLT owners participate on CLT boards. They're very invested in their community, and the relationship with the homeowner does not stop when the homeowner buys the property. It continues on as long as they're in the property, and actually in some cases there are people that have sold their CLT homes and have still participated or stay connected to the CLTs. One of the great statistics that I like to bring out, especially now in the foreclosure crisis that doesn't seem to be going away, is that nationally CLT homeowners are 1/130th at the risk of foreclosure than the national regular homeowner. And in Minnesota, I believe last year it was 1 out of 32 were facing foreclosure in across Minnesota, and with CLT homeowners it's closer to 1 out of 75. And one of the reasons that we are, aside from the 30-year mortgages, and is the relationship with the land trust, because the land trust often can work with the homeowners if there's a problem brewing. They know about it ahead of time because of the relationship, and they can intervene and help with solutions, and so they are able to keep their homes. They're affected by loss of jobs and medical health issues, et cetera, just like the regular public, and so there is a strong relationship there. Thank you for letting me testify. I'd like to turn it over to Sean. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Clark and members of the committee. My name is Sean Allen. I'm the Executive Director of First Homes in Rochester, and we are a land trust that's been around since 2001. We serve an area both in Rochester and most of, I guess, southeastern Minnesota. We have land trust homes in, I think, 7 counties around the southeastern part of the state. We've created more than 900 units since 2000. We began as a partnership with the business community and our local community foundation, the Rochester Area Foundation, and other many municipalities around our area, as well as state government. And that has created 900 units, 200 of which roughly are community land trust homes during that time. The Mayo Clinic was heavily involved early on with our efforts and continues to be involved. The we are the largest community land trust in the state, and Duluth is close behind. There are, as has been mentioned, land trusts throughout the state, and we have come together to ask for this particular bonding bill. And we support, as Pat said, the other bonding bill that is out there. The reason that in Rochester we've really focused on the community land trust is that long-term permanence of affordability. We've changed our focus over the years, just since 2001, to focus more on inner-city neighborhoods in Rochester, which have experienced some significant disinvestment. And in fact, during this foreclosure crisis, the highest kind of prominence of foreclosures probably in southern Minnesota has been in the downtown core areas of Rochester. We've gone in, and because we're a community foundation, we focus first on long-range neighborhood planning and done work with neighborhood leaders. We have brought, through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, brought neighborhood stabilization program dollars to fight the foreclosure crisis, and we are utilizing those funds to create more community land trust units. The beauty of that is in these neighborhoods that, as you're adding subsidy and additional investment into the neighborhoods, as other private investment comes into those neighborhoods, the land trust homes stay as part of the permanent infrastructure of affordability. And so gentrification, while it does start to occur, it is thwarted somewhat by having these homes scattered throughout these neighborhoods. And I guess the last thing I would say is that this bonding effort is critical because we really need additional funds to purchase land, to leverage other state federal funding that we've been very successful already at creating. The 200 additional housing units we're talking about here would be scattered throughout all the land trusts in the state. And just thank you for your support.
Okay. Any questions or comments from committee members? Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I just ask, I have one question. Do we not allow the property owner, would they ever be able to buy the lot? Say they started to do well financially, do we allow them to buy the lot?
Oh, that's an excellent question. We get it every time we sell a house. The answer is no. We hope that the people, if they get into a better financial situation, they can move out of that home and into another home that suits their needs better. What that does is it opens up that lower income home to someone who really needs it. So the investment that you've made and the municipalities have made and that businesses have made doesn't get used to support a family that doesn't need the subsidy, essentially.
Ms. McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anything in the law that requires that would not be able to be, could a community trust, I mean, I would assume that if they paid it off, you could use that money then to buy a different lot. I'm trying to think why you want to kind of encourage somebody to get chased out of this house if it's meeting their needs. Would the law not allow them to buy that, or is that just the way they're set up?
As far as I know, there's no legal requirement that we would have to, that has to stay in the land trust. We could theoretically sell the home or the land to that homeowner. We don't do that because our goal is to really keep that land in trust forever so that home continues to recycle and continues to be a affordable home for generations of families. If we were to sell lots to the homeowners in those particular areas, what we do is we would end up moving the subsidy from one house to another. There is a loss there in what that subsidy can buy. I think is our issue.
Madam Chair, Representative, you might also remember that the owner is not chased out of the property. They stay there as long as they choose to stay there. And when they reach the point they would like to move on, then they do that. They do get compensation for, I understand, the increase in value of the house itself. But since the community and the business community are making investments in the community, it seems only reasonable that those benefits ought to continue
so that other families can also have that advantage. But the family has already received a benefit through subsidies from the private sector and from government. And so they will benefit, I believe, from the increase in the value of the house itself. But this allows this program to continue so that additional families over that 99-year lease can have advantage of something that was really provided by the community.
One more question, then we're going to move along.
Okay, but I would just look at it from the other side. You've got this family that now is doing very well, and they want to stay in this neighborhood, and they've got the ability, and they like their house, and they'd like to own their lot. I would think we would want to encourage that, and even if it was for a profit for the community trust, where they like their home, they like where they live, and they've become better, more well off, or whatever, got a new better job, or just are doing better. I would think that would be good for the neighborhood to have that person want to stay there, improve it, and maybe we can even only sell it to them at a profit. You know, that's not a bad word. That'd be a good thing. And the community trust would have more money. It would encourage. I'm trying to understand why we don't want to allow that to happen. I think that would be good for it to come into private ownership. And you would then, and after I think about it, I think you'd want to make some money on the deal to encourage them. I'll let it go at that, Madam Chair. But I really like this. I really like this bill. I like this idea. I'm glad the governor likes it. I just would like to understand that better. So I got a feeling Julian or somebody might be stopping by. Well, thank you.
All right. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of have a couple of questions about the development, how you acquire, but to Representative McNamara's point, I think I like to look at it from the perspective of the family as they have to share in the equity. So if they do get in a better financial situation, if the housing market improves, they would have to share in the equity of whatever that improvement would be per the agreement that they signed up for. And so if you decided that you wanted to move, one of the things that would happen is that you would sell that house, you'd share in the equity with the land trust, you would then buy a new house, and you wouldn't have the land trust subsidy. And if the market continues to increase and you continue to do better, that's the kind of situation that you would really want to be. So I look at it conversely to say that if things started to go well for you and the land trust was no longer something that you felt like you needed, you wanted to get out of that relationship and into a new relationship that was going to benefit you. That's the profit that you would see in your pocket because you wouldn't no longer have to share that with the land trust organization. That's just another perspective. I mean, I'm not arguing it. I was just trying to give you maybe another perspective on what kind of how the land trust is set up. And that in addition to that, the land trust is set up so that there is an opportunity for people who are low income to move into that nice neighborhood so that we have a deconcentration of poverty and that everybody who is in that situation doesn't have to live in a certain part of town. They can kind of live, you know, in these communities that we have developed throughout whatever municipality that you're in. So I think that there is some great benefit to keeping the land in trust as we do our waterways and other things that we do in the more, you know, environmental sense. The question that I have for you guys is the $5 million for the bond, is this going to primarily be new development that you look for, or is it going to be homeowner initiated, or what do you think the mix is going to be in the new bonds that you would get from this bill?
Well, Representative Hayden, I can...
Mr. Allen.
Thank you. I guess I'm not sure exactly. I think each individual land trust would have to assess what their needs are in particular. I think there is a need for foreclosure dollars, particularly for communities that have not received NSP funding. But I think that there, because of what you're talking about, this need for scattering affordability among many different neighborhoods, I don't think it should be restricted just to foreclosed homes. I think it needs to be more broadly put out there so that communities can figure out exactly what they need to do. So I guess I can't speak for every land trust. For us, it would probably mostly be used for purchasing of homes, many of which would be foreclosed, rehabilitating them, and then putting them into the land trust.
Thank you. Any further questions, comments from committee members? Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I might mention that this idea, I think, has had in the past bipartisan support, and I'd also like to remind the committee that the request of $5 million bonding authorization is a very, very moderate one and does take into consideration the economic circumstances our state finds itself in at present.
Thank you very much. Before I take the seat up there, because I'm going to present my bill in a minute, and I think we'll maybe ask Representative Mariani to join me, but first I want to introduce, we have a new administrator, Christine Murphy, and I think some of you may have had a chance to talk with her. I want to welcome her aboard. We're really happy to have her. She's a good background that will be very helpful to us. And we also have a new House research person, Ms. Burris. Matt Burris, welcome. And I'm not sure if we have anybody else that's new. That's not. Okay, well, thank you. And Representative Lane, do you want to take it? Excuse me. What's your name, Hannah? Anna? I believe you're new to this committee too, is that right? Okay, we're just introducing everybody who's new, and I just wanted to get your attention and just say welcome to the committee. We're happy to have you. Thank you.
And now we'll move to House File 1354 with Representative Clark. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Well, this bill that I'm bringing before for you, I won't claim to be moderate because I think we're in a pretty big crisis. So I'm asking the committee to take a big step forward here. We're talking in House File 1354 of $100 million in nonprofit bonds that would be available through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for three purposes: to do the usual purpose that we've been talking about earlier, to build housing, to acquire the land, to do the pre-design construction, the whole ball of wax that we do when we're talking about bonding for housing. And then also we mentioned in the bill that it can be used to acquire vacant or foreclosed residential property to renovate at affordable prices, and then they may also be used for the purpose of making loans to neighborhood land trusts that we've just been talking about. And what accompanies that appropriation, it would be the $8 million in costs that would be appropriated for the debt service. So that's basically the bill. It's pretty simple. I do want to make sure that we get a chance to hear from some of the folks who have spent some time working with me on this. So I'm going to ask Mr. Halbeck, first of all, to make a few comments, and then we have four witnesses that we'd like to call forward. So Mr. Halbeck.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair Substitute. Chip Halbach with Minnesota Housing Partnership. And I'll just say a couple of words because there are a number of people who want to speak to the bill. The bill itself, as Representative Clark mentioned, is $100 million in nonprofit bonding for a variety of housing needs facing the state. We believe that the bill is primarily a statement of where Minnesota should go in terms of this precious bond resource in meeting some fundamental needs across Minnesota. We believe as the state leaders discuss a bonding total ranging from about $700 million to over $1 billion, $100 million for affordable housing, about 10% of what's being talked about, is an appropriate number in terms of the need and also what can happen. Of course, the housing needs, as discussed from the representatives of public housing, land trust, and the people who will follow, are critical. The state has very flat income for renters, declining incomes for renters. Of course, many people are falling behind in home ownership, their mortgages, and losing their homes. That there is an immense housing crisis out there that this type of investment can offset. But secondly, that this investment in housing construction, as will be testified later, is an immense job creator. You will be hard-pressed to find any other type of state investment that will produce more good-paying jobs and jobs for people who have immense skills but are sitting at home than you will with an investment in affordable housing. In addition, there certainly will be jobs for people through the apprenticeship programs, bringing people from low-income communities and minority people into this profession. And then third is, as was mentioned earlier, an investment in the state's affordable housing is an investment in green. It's an investment in energy efficiency and healthy homes. The state housing agency has adopted green priorities for all of its housing investment. And so you can be assured that the dollars going into affordable housing in this state are ones that meet a variety of needs. Then finally, I would just say, because the state agency does a good job of distributing funds, that this investment in affordable housing is something that can help communities across the state. Again, we will hear about a survey that our organization and the Metropolitan Consortium have recently completed or in the process of completion, but it shows that there's housing developers are ready to build within 12 months housing over 200 projects in over 100 communities. It ranges from need for $90,000 to rehab home ownership homes in Wadena up to $10 million for the renovation of the Harriet Tubman Center in Minneapolis. So just with that thanks to Representative Clark for bringing forward the scale of funding that's needed for the housing needs of the state, but also for putting people to work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Clark?
Yes, I'd like to ask Mike Horowitz, Kyle Makarios, Kristen Beckman, you might as well come on down. And then did we let Representative Mariani know? Yeah. Why don't we go ahead and let him know, because I want to make sure we at least get his bill mentioned, even though we're going to be a little short on time. So, Mike, do you want to say?
My name is Kristen Beckman. I'm the Government Relations Director for Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. As Assistant Commissioner Orr mentioned earlier, the MHFA put together a proposal of $40 million for bonding, and we appreciated that proposal. And it incorporated two of the previous bills, the GO bonds for public housing and then the bonds for the Community Land Trust. And so we had looked at that. We're part of, Twin Cities Habitat is a part of the Housing Jobs Campaign, which is run by the Minnesota Housing Partnership and the Minnesota Consortium of Community Developers. And it's a coalition of for-profit and non-profit developers and labor unions that have come together to talk about how we can both stabilize the housing market and stabilize the economy by investing in affordable housing. And so we have... We're together looking as the coalition looking at the MHFA proposal, hoping that the governor accepted that, and we also were disappointed that he only accepted about an eighth of what the agency recommended to him. As Chip mentioned, we did a survey of developers around the state asking who could start building and who could start hiring people to build around the state, and we found 202 shovel-ready projects. And as we were looking at the projects, including Twin Cities Habitat projects, they are not fundable with C3 nonprofit bonds or with the general obligation bonds. About two-thirds of them aren't. And so then we were trying to figure out how could we expand the existing proposal so that there could be bonding resources that would be available to the two-thirds of these 202 shovel-ready projects. And so that's where the idea came of, you know, doing $40 million in GO bonds and nonprofit bonds, and then potentially $60 million in appropriations bonds to add up to the $100 million that's in Chair Clark's proposal. And so we appreciate the opportunity to sort of discuss with us today the handouts that just got passed around. I know in past conversations in this community or in this committee, there was a question of the distribution of resources across the state for housing. And you can really see by the map that these 202 shovel-ready projects really are broadly distributed across the state, and that the resources that you would invest in the bonding and the debt service on the bonds would really be shared by communities in all regions. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mike, who is a developer from St. Cloud, and he can kind of give an example of the projects that would be in the pipeline and the jobs that would be created. And
sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee,
yes.
My name is Mike Potowicz, and I'm
welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I am a developer out of St. Cloud, Minnesota. My company's been around since 1984. Always doing multifamily housing. I've had the privilege of doing over 5,000 units in the state of Minnesota. Prior to that, I was a city manager and a public housing authority director, and my life, whole history has been in housing. And predominance of it has been in outstate Minnesota, delivering developments, both new construction and acquisition and rehab, which extends the economic life of those developments, brings them up to energy code. As a matter of fact, there's a federal tax incentive right now that if you cut your utility consumption in half, you get a benefit from the federal government, which helps make these deals happen. So there's all kinds of incentives that we're trying to tie back into this proposal. But as Kristen said, 139 of the 202 developments wouldn't happen without an appropriations bill. And these are primarily new construction, acquisition, and rehab, and some single-family projects, the bulk of which are relying on tax credits. And tax credits right now have experienced a severe decline, not only in Minnesota, but nationwide, as the primary investors, banks, have no longer showing profit on their balance sheets. They're no longer the significant investor, nor Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. So you've had a fall off in investment dollars, so there's less equity dollars. And you've had, at the same time, a reduction in the amount that those credits are worth. So what we've got now in Minnesota is probably 3 out of 30-some active syndicators in Minnesota that have developed projects in the last couple of years. And that's not only today, but it's into the future until our economy stabilizes. The secondary thing about that investment is that those folks are absent from the marketplace. At the same time, we're looking at bank rates going up. So you've got lack of equity dollars, higher interest costs, at a point in time when the agency is faced with the biggest challenge of all, where 1 in 8 Minnesotans is using their scarce resources for housing and is actually foregoing some of the other requirements in their life in order to maintain their subsistence. This program will allow the state, through its challenge program, to take those dollars, to provide them back out to the development community, provide affordable rental housing opportunities to these people, and to help employ the over 10,000 people in the construction trade industry, the residential trade industry, that lost their jobs between the period of 2005 and 2009, and also to employ folks back in the wood industry in northern Minnesota, which in the Midwest alone has lost $15,000 jobs because this whole industry has collapsed. So we feel it's a unique opportunity for the state to existing programs to use this appropriation to create employment opportunities. One half of that money is returned to the state within the first year based off the construction activity alone. So we think it's a good short and long-term investment on a human scale for those that are employed, on a human scale for those that need safe, sanitary, and standard housing, and for the state of Minnesota for its future.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Members, Madam Chair, my name is Kyle Makarios. I'm the political director for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. We represent 12,000 carpenters, millwrights, lathers, floor covers, and pile drivers in the state of Minnesota. But unfortunately, 26% of our active members are not working today. Actually, significantly higher. 26% of our members are on our out-of-work list, and another quarter or more of them are working 2 to 3 days a week, staying on the payroll of the companies they work for, barely. Our total work hours for the last few months have been 40% off normal activity. We are experiencing devastating employment numbers for our members, many of whom are dealing with long-term unemployment. But from the perspective of creating jobs, which is what we are primarily interested in with this bill, we think that investments in housing, particularly by the state, make a lot of sense. And that's for a couple of important reasons. The first one is, and the most important one is leverage, that unlike many of the other bonding proposals, $1 of state money does not mean $1 of construction activity. When it comes to housing, it means significantly more than that because of the other sources of funds also that also must go into these developments to make them happen. So $1 of state investment actually means significantly more than $1 of construction activity because of the leverage factor. And then secondly, that housing construction, new construction as well, and particularly rehabilitation, is just much more labor-intensive than other types of construction. We get more work hours out of this type of work. And lastly, as Mike mentioned, the wood products industry in Minnesota is in particularly rough shape, and investments in housing have a spin-off effect in the wood products industry that we think will have a very positive impact on jobs in the state.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Well, committee members, I wonder if you have any questions or concerns. We're really hoping we can move forward on this. I'm actually waiting for Representative Mariani, who has a bill that goes a little bit, has a little bit more to it, but begins to talk about.
Representative Hayden?
No, I said Representative Mariani. Yeah,
oh. Okay. Is there anyone that has some questions? Representative Clark, this is a very large bill,
mm-hmm.
and you're putting together a lot of other bills. Is that the idea? A lot of other proposals will all be encompassed in this one?
Oh, the way the process is working, Madam Chair, is that we will look at each of these bills, and we're looking at them today individually, and then we make a recommendation to the chair of the bonding committee. And we're not, this year, we're going to be doing it as a memo. We're not doing it in the way they did in the past, and the reason for that is that we're trying to move very quickly to get this bonding bill on the road. And I think the reason that it is the size of, that you mentioned is it's a good size bill. The reason for that is that we are we're in a huge housing crisis. This is one of the best job creating bills that we can do. Plus, we have so many people right now who are homeless. The foreclosure rate out there is not getting better. We just have a lot of need, and so as we make the recommendations from this committee, we'll be talking about each of the bills, and the bonding committee, which I happen to serve on, will actually be taking all those things into consideration. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm interested in any of your responses. We're going to send this memo forward, and it will include this amount. I have to just say this bill that I have is evolving a little bit because we do have some new information about guidelines that we just found out about, I think, on Friday last week. In terms of the nonprofit housing bonds. But since we have Representative Mariani here, I want to take the opportunity. I know he came from another committee, and his bill is very similar. It has some additional components, though.
Okay, welcome, Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone again. Happy New Year. I don't have a whole lot to add. I sat in on Representative Nelson's hearing where I thought a strong case was made in terms of our state's need for investing in our current housing stock and expanding, particularly our affordable housing units in the state. The only thing I understand Ms. Jacobs spoke about the NEED program is that no one spoke?
I don't know if she's here yet. Oh, there she is. Okay.
Oh, there.
So we should take some testimony on that.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, that really is the only unique piece in my bill relative to the other pieces. And maybe she can come forward. I'll just quickly say that I think part of the thinking here with this particular bill, and this one was drafted at the end of the last legislative session, so obviously there's been some changes. There's been new bills that have been introduced, but I think part of what this bill begs us to do is to think more holistically and comprehensively about several important pieces here. One piece, of course, is the need in our state for investing in more affordable housing. The other is for a need in our state to really push forward with expanding green energy conservation concepts and techniques in our state, particularly through our housing. And then the third critical component here is a way to engage those who are, and there are many, unfortunately, unemployed with some skills that can make a contribution to this sector and this development. And we have an old model from the 1980s that provided a strong, powerful way to do a wage subsidy that kept people engaged in the working force and while making important contributions to society. And so maybe we can just hear very quickly, Madam Chair, a little bit about that particular piece.
Yes, welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chris Jacobs. I'm Executive Director of the Jobs Now Coalition. That's 120 organizations statewide. We are the oldest and largest employment policy coalition in the nation. I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 2406 with its emphasis on reviving the Minnesota Emergency Employment Development Program, known by its acronym as MEED. The program was in place from 83 to 89. During that time, about 45,000 people enrolled in the program, which provided a wage subsidy of up to $4 per hour, would be $10 an hour in 2008 dollars. For employers to hire new workers, many of whom were low-skilled or among the long-term unemployed. Employment was created in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. Following their MEED experience, more than 20,000 of those workers succeeded in staying on with their employer or finding another permanent, unsubsidized employment, according to a report by the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Tim Bartik, senior economist for the Upjohn Institute, was here last month and called, he's an expert on the program, called MEED one of the most innovative employment programs done anywhere in the U.S. in the last 50 years, and it deserves to be revived, unquote. In Minnesota, 7,400 jobs were created in the first 6 months of the program. The current statewide Minnesota job gap, I will remind you, is 8 job seekers for every job opening. Minnesota businesses and nonprofit organizations would be willing to take the risk to hire new workers if they could get some help to do so. A recent survey of nonprofits by the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits showed that the sector would triple its hiring from 400 new jobs projected to 1,200 if they have access to a wage subsidy program. Private employers I've spoken to would welcome the program, as would unemployed workers all across the state of Minnesota. This program is being considered at the national level, and we strongly support reviving this lifeline program. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clark? Or Mariani.
Well, Madam Chair and members, again, I think the idea, particularly with this kind of hearing, is to be able to look at all sorts of different pieces that could be put together for a really comprehensive vision that can actually very quickly move forward some important development in the state, but also some job employment. There are obvious weaknesses with some of this, and one is that it does require, depending on your perspective, a weakness or not, it does require an investment out of the state. Now, obviously, with bonding, even though that still continues to be something that affects our cash flow and our bill and has some ramifications on our general fund, that's traditionally has been a more doable type of investment for states. Obviously, dipping into the general fund to be able to subsidize these kind of programs is very challenging at any time. It's particularly challenging at any time. It's particularly challenging in these times. And I just simply want to acknowledge that. The point here is that before we, what I want to encourage is that before we, nix ideas because of the fact that we're in a deficit in the state, is that we think through what we have learned in the past from how we've used general fund investments to drive some important policy. And in the 1980s, we drove very important policy that really helped to stabilize a a very difficult to stabilize part of our labor force. There is a continued need to do that, and maybe there's another creative way in which we find that investment. But the first, you know, point is to really think about the lessons learned from that NEED program and to see whether or not they might be applicable for any kind of matching up for any kind of bonding investments that we might make in the future.
Thank you. Committee questions? Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Potowitz could come back down for a couple of questions. Maybe you don't know the answers to some of these questions, and maybe Chair Clark can help fill us in. Do you have any idea approximately how many units would be able to be built with this kind of money?
I do not. Because of the variety, it would be a combination of single-family and the $60 million now that would be following the Challenge Fund, which is the portion of the bill that I am familiar with. It would do single-family, new construction multifamily, and acquisition and rehab of existing multifamily.
Right.
And each one of those has a different rating and ranking system and a different need.
Okay.
Just as I recall from the testimony, thank you, Madam Chair, we were talking about 200 projects in about 100 counties, so I'm not exactly sure how many units that is. Again, that's that can't be 100 counties. 200 projects in 100 different places in the counties.
Okay. And my next question, I guess, for Mr. Podwelps would be, in today's market, because I know there's still vacancies out there in multifamily, and what would this do to that, to the private market, to build a bunch of new buildings, I guess, and units?
For the state selection criteria that the State Housing Finance Agency, who would administer these funds, utilizes, it requires the developer to do their own market analysis and to submit it as part of the package. The state reviews it, the lender reviews it, and also the investor reviews it. So frankly, we've not seen a lot of competitive new developments in markets that are saturated. And there are markets that vary throughout the state that there's demand in certain sectors, and in other sectors there's not. So I trust that the product that the state would approve would be done prudently, and it would result in no increased vacancy, because it wouldn't be units provided in markets that are already saturated.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Any further questions from the committee members? Representative Scott.
Yeah, I just had one more for Representative Clark. You know, the interest on the bonding, how would we pay for that?
Representative Clark.
Good question. It's to be determined. We have been kind of in a struggle about that, frankly, trying to figure that out for the last session and this session. And I understand there's some decision coming down shortly, but we don't have clarity whether or not this committee would have to absorb that as our cost, or if it would be more from the general fund.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. I just wanted to say this is very interesting. As you said, Representative Marini, a comprehensive vision has to do with jobs. I know that the bonding bill produces, our goal in the bonding bill is producing jobs, and this seems to be one that really has a greater percentage of jobs coming out of the dollar invested in the bonding bill. So I appreciate that, and the foreclosure problem and the homelessness, it seems to hit them all. Thank you.
Chair, if I could just comment, I happened to be here way back in the 80s when Representative Mariani was talking about when the NEED bill was going through, and it was a very, very successful program. It meant a lot, and it really helped us through a very critical time, and so I would look forward to us being able to reinstate that in the form that's being talked about here today. So, Madam Chair, that's our testimony, and I'd like to just assume the chair for a minute. I understand we have another witness who wants to testify.
All right,
Thank you, committee members. I received a note on another person who would like to testify, I think, in general, or at least on several bills, and so we're going to give her a chance, and then after that we'll be adjourning. Ms. Lee? Yeah, you have about, maybe, looks like about 3 or 4 minutes.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, Arna Family Centers, and also speaking as a member of the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. We also do reporting to the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and I know they're short-staffed, so we don't have their particular representation here. The two bills that I wanted to make comments on was the House File 2406 and House File 1354. Now, as I understand it from Representative Mariani, Article 2 regarding the federal stimulus funds, giving priority to agencies that have already received federal stimulus funds. We have tried to track the federal stimulus money, and there were a number of organizations that were credible enough and could qualify, but due to limited funds, they had certain, preferences on the number of applicants. And we feel that this particular section should not exclude any qualifying agency that might qualify for the funds otherwise, other than that they have not received federal funds. So I guess we find a problem with that. Now, the other thing is, on Article 1, Section 4, we notice also that public housing refers to, and both that and the green energy investments refers to agencies that receive grants or loans. In your other bills, you have some agencies receiving grants, others qualify for loans. I've been a reviewer of RFPs in the past for a number of different organizations, and it does make a difference whether an agency receives a grant that can leverage getting funds from other sources versus a loan, which they don't. So this puts those who do not receive grants, as far as nonprofit organizations, at a disadvantage because they don't receive the grants. And if you are giving grants, I only ask that, fair consideration be given to all qualifying agencies rather than limiting it to just a limited few. I'm also concerned about the TURF issues when I talked to, well, I'm sorry, it wasn't 1354, sorry about that. It was the House File 4641, which related to, we're fine with yours, which related to funds, grants for land trusts. Hawaii has been what you would call a state of land trusts since the time they first became a state in the 1951. The issue there is that all owners have the option of making theirs technically a land trust or not. They're called leasehold versus fee simple. Owners have the ability to sell the home buyer their land also. So I'm saying that if you see land trust as a way to make homes affordable, that it can't be necessarily limited to just a few organizations, that other organizations, including nonprofits who are not considered land trusts, that are also in the same boat, only they don't receive the grants and they aren't considered land trusts, but they perform the same duties as these approved land trusts, that they be on equal footing, because basically land trusts do perform some of the same duties as these other nonprofit organizations. But if you're looking for overall affordability around the state, something for future consideration would be to make it an option for any homeowner to be able to do. So with those comments, I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who desires to testify? If not, committee is adjourned.